Hi, I'm Doug Gottlieb, and welcome in to this week's edition of All Ball. We got a great show for you, a great pod for you, excuse me, as Stephen Pearl, assistant coach at Auburn, who just won the SEC tournament, went to the Final Four and lost on a crazy series of events that led to Kyle Guy making three free throws in a row. Stephen Pearl is going to join us. We'll talk about his personal journey to becoming an assistant coach, playing for his dad, what this has been like being beside his dad as a player when he got fired at Tennessee, what he did when his dad went to TV, and how he's climbed the ladder at Auburn to be kind of the defensive guru, if you will, for the Auburn Tigers in the SEC tournament championship and Final Four run. But I want to start with a guy who passed away this week at the age of 81. His name's John McLeod. And kind of the quick rundown of John McLeod. He was the head coach at Oklahoma with Alvin Adams. He then went to the pros and was the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, coached in what many people believe to be the greatest NBA game of all time, 4 overtime NBA Finals game against the Boston Celtics. He was later the head coach of the Dallas Mavericks and the New York Knicks. And he was my head coach at Notre Dame. And while I would be honest, like, he really unique career path, right? Like, he was a boxer. He was not a basketball player growing up. And then he was a high school coach before he became a college coach. So just unique in terms of the comparison to my life growing up in a basketball household. That said, what basketball lost, maybe what society lost, was a complete and total gentleman. And some of these things are kind of funny and clever and interesting. And I'll have a couple of my former teammates on who are on to bigger and brighter things since playing at Notre Dame. But I first met him, or first talked to him on the phone, in 1994. 94, I got home from ABCD camp. Back then, there was Nike and ABCD. We were a Sonny Vaccaro ABCD kind of group, our high school team, AU team. Sonny had sponsored us back when he was at Nike, and we followed him to Converse and then to Adidas. Got home from ABCD, which was at Fairleigh Dickinson. The year before, I hadn't played as well at Ypsilanti. I was young and I was okay. And then I started getting recruited by a couple of high majors. And then Notre Dame called the first day I got home. And I'll never forget the phone call. Dougie, this is Coach John McLeod. I'm head coach at Notre Dame. How'd you like to be a member of the Irish? And I was like, well, Coach, Notre Dame's a great school. And he said, well, tomorrow we're going to announce we're going to the Big East Conference. You watch the Big East Conference? And I was like, yeah, Coach. I mean, I grew up loving the Big East. You know, Scott McCorkle and Mike Hopkins and LaRon Ellis. They played for my dad. And, of course, my mom went to Syracuse and watched UConn and Georgetown and Villanova and Boston College and all those teams. Tomorrow we're going to announce Notre Dame is going to join the Big East Conference and you'd be my starting point guard the first year in the Big East. How's that sound? He was like, I'd love to go. I'd love to take a visit to Notre Dame. I didn't grow up Jewish. I didn't grow up an Irish Catholic Notre Dame fan, but I wanted to see Notre Dame play football against Michigan, and I got that wish. It was an amazing weekend, and you know they're trying to convince us that that's not touchdown Jesus, that's 3-point Jesus. But here's the thing. Most of you who are basketball dudes or basketball ladies that listen to this podcast, you know that perception does not match reality. Sometimes recruiters can be a little gray with the truth. Head coaches can as well. But there's often more and more good people than there are bad people in this sport. John McLeod was the best of those type of people. He meant what he said and said what he meant. And I've never met a man that was such a gentleman, right? Like literally a gentleman, would not scream at you, would not curse at you. And everything he said he would do at Notre Dame for me, he did. I didn't live up to my end of the bargain. He lived up to his. So from the moment I first arrived at Notre Dame till the time, even after I left, he always did what he said and said what he would do. So I'll share a couple quick stories. So John McLeod was, he was a gentleman, and he believed Notre Dame, we have to dress with class. They watch us. And so we were coat and tie every airplane, every bus ride. And when we were in the hotel, like you couldn't dress like a slob. Like you had to wear your Nike Notre Dame sweats and a specific shirt underneath. And everything had to be tucked in. Everything had to be, with the exception of Keith Kurowski from Christian Brothers, Jersey kid who had some boogers on his sleeve. With that is the exception. Everybody was like clean shaven, looked kind of well put together. He used to make us, you'd get up to leave the table and you weren't dismissed until you tucked your chair in under the table. Look people in the eye. I'll never forget my first team meeting at Notre Dame. He drew up like a makeshift auditorium and he circles the first two rows and he says, not there, not there, not there. Notre Dame, we sit in the first two rows. And we honestly had the ability to audible out of practice, out of any sort of workout, if it was pertaining to school. You had to study for a test? Go. We'll see. Let it go. And he said that would be his, and no matter how bad or how tough the season was, that's what we would do. He didn't raise his voice to you. He would get stern, and he would get mad, and he would say, Notre Dame, we're immature. But if he really wanted to lay into you, you'd get back to your dorm room, there'd be a red blinking light, it'd be a secretary, he'd say, coach would want to see you at such and such time. You'd come in, she'd be very nice, he'd be very nice and formal, shake your hand, you'd walk in, he'd close the door, and that's when he would play some tape, and it wasn't usually good. He was a man of immense class, respect, dignity, and integrity. And I, you know, like, look, it might be selfish to say, or self, I don't know what the term is, like egotistical, I think, to say, but I have no doubt had I not gotten in trouble at Notre Dame, he would have kept his job longer. Because we were, you know, as Pat Garrity was a sophomore, I was a freshman, and Tony Weish and Phil Hickey were freshmen as well. And we were adding a really good recruiting class, and my boy David Lalazarian was coming out from my high school. And, you know, by my senior year, I have no doubt that was the year he got fired. After what would have been my senior year, we got fired. We would have made an NCAA tournament, right? We would have made an NCAA tournament. He would have kept his job. But, and even after that, he wasn't bitter. Well, I posted a letter on Facebook. He wasn't bitter. He wasn't a jerk. He was always so classy and so dignified, even though I had done his program wrong. Not just in my actions and the way it made his program look, but remember at Notre Dame at that point in time, they weren't allowed to take transfers. You couldn't go late. There were no grad transfers. There were no transfers period late in the year. They didn't take any. We had guys that wanted to transfer and play. Couldn't take any. That was the university's policy. Obviously, it changed the second he got fired. I think Matt Doherty got to take Ryan Humphries from Oklahoma, and history changed. So, look, you can remember him as an incredible college coach. You can remember him as a coach who coached Alvin Adams to success at Oklahoma, or a coach for a short period of time at Notre Dame. We ran what would be kind of blocker mover, or I called a two-side motion. We ran a lot of NBA sets. There were some defensively. We forced middle. We were kind of pack line before anybody called it pack line. But I think he should be remembered as a guy that carried himself with incredible class, dignity, and integrity. And, I mean, he even smelled good. His hair was always cut. I never saw him unshaven, ever. Like, you know, you're around a guy an entire year, you think there's one day he comes in, you're like, man, he must have stayed up late watching tape. Nope, not Johnny Mack. Passed away at the age of 81 years old, a legendary NBA head coach who I got a chance to play for my year at Notre Dame. Let me kind of quickly give you, I want to play for you a clip of what Kevin Durant said to the media in regards to why people think he's being passive.
Well, we had a nice Florida game. You know, let's go back to the whole last month of the season. We've been playing this way for a while. And when we got to this series, you know, game one, we had some nice momentum. They're playing a gimmick defense, which has been working, top blocking everything on the perimeter. So guys not even looking at the three-point line. They're just forcing guys inside the three-point line. So for us, when I get the ball in my spots, you know, I got a pest, Patrick Beverly, who was up underneath me. Well, I could definitely shoot over top and score every time if it's a one-on-one situation. But we got a guy that's dropping and helping, and then we got another guy that's just sitting on me waiting for me to dribble the basketball. If I put the basketball on the floor, I could probably make 43% of my shots if I shoot them like that. But that's not really going to do nothing for us at with the outcome of the game, you know, because we got a nice flow, everybody touching the rock.
Now, you may not want to hear it, and you may not want to accept it, and you may wonder why KD would get a pass from people. I don't think he does. I think it's pretty interesting. Like, here's a guy who people have said too much of a ball stopper, too much one-on-one. He kind of ruins what Golden State is, and then he tries to buy into what Golden State's doing, and they get beat. They did lead. Like, I wouldn't bury the lead. They were up 31 points. His passive nature was working. He wasn't on the floor for all of the 31-point comeback. But I thought that was really interesting. Look, they're playing a defense, which I got one underneath me, and I got a dude waiting for me. And we got to figure out ways to score. They're running us off the three-point line. And our attack, however flawed it became, we were up 31 points. I find Kevin Durant to be amazing to watch. I'm interested to see what he does in Game 3. I'm fascinated by the idea that even though he outplayed LeBron James in the last two NBA Finals, and he's won an NBA MVP, and he can play both ends, and he has a virtually unstoppable pull-up jump shot, he still can't seem to win people over. Why? Because he fights the people on Twitter? Or is it because he left the Oklahoma City Thunder? One of the reasons he left the Oklahoma City Thunder was this type of defense. There was always two guys on him. Always. But I'm a little concerned if I was the Thunder in regards to the Rockets. It's not just losing DeMarcus Cousins, who I'm not convinced made them better, but this team was not built to have a viable backup big guy. Like, KD has two guys on him because Kevon Looney, you're going to leave him open. You're going to dare him. Kevon Looney, he scores 30. We tip our cap to you. That's how you think. So between Looney and Jordan Bell, and who's had his own issues with Steve Kerr, or Andre Iguodala, does he have enough left in the tank? Or Sean Livingston? Like, can they find that fifth guy, and can they get enough offense out of the non-big three? We shall see. But I thought that was a perfectly interesting response. He told you he responded to basketball questions. That's a basketball question. He gave you a thorough answer. What more do you want? I don't know. But he also told you he was the best player in the game, and then he outplayed LeBron James in the last two NBA Finals. What more do you want? I don't know. I still think it's going to end up with the Celtics will win. I think the Raptors are going to win. I think the Rocket series is going to be amazing against the Golden State Warriors, but I would guess the Warriors still have enough. But we'll see. Last thing is this in regards to the grad transfer rules, which may change. I understand that we want to create freedom for athletes and to benefit from the fact that you graduate on time, you should get another year. You should get that year of eligibility to spend wherever you want, but you should still have to sit out a year because we're destroying the low majors. It also puts the high majors like UCLA and Cal and programs that have really no grad program that you can transfer into at a late date, puts them at a prohibitive disadvantage. More than anything, hurts the parity of the sport. I'm not saying you can't transfer up from a lower level to a higher level if you get better and you improve. Does it leave your boys in the dust? Sure. But one, there's some buyer beware. There's the Cremos of the world, the kid from Albany that destroys Albany. You lose your best player. And he didn't help Villanova. He was better at a lower level. But it also, if you're a player, where's your home? Where's your alma mater? You spend 2, 3, 4 years at a place, and then you leave because you got another year left and you could transfer up. Like, I don't think you're going back to that place, and you're not a member of the new place where you graduate. All right, let's get you to Stephen Pearl. He's a longtime friend of mine. He's assistant coach at Auburn. Auburn won the SEC tournament, went all the way to the Final Four, and nearly beat Virginia, as you know, in the national semifinals. All right, so, like, here's the interesting part, Pearl. Here's the interesting part, is there are some, is it a Venn diagram, right, where we have the concentric, the circles that kind of combined, right, between your dad and my dad's relationship, both of them having coached at UW-Milwaukee. And then of course, you know, the Maccabi Games thing, like there's some definitely ties that bind. You're born in Indiana, weren't you?
I was born in Iowa City, Iowa, when coach was an assistant under Dr. Tom Davis.
Okay. That's the first part we want to get to, is not just under Dr. Tom Davis, but the fact that you have a tendency to call him coach. Like, is there a time you also call him BP? Like, when did it switch from when is there ever a dad, or is there a Bruce, or how do you address your father?
I think it all switched when I started playing at Tennessee. I think it switched to coach and BP pretty quickly, because you didn't want to be, that guy on the team calling your coach dad. So ever since I played for him, because I never really played for him growing up. He coached baseball or football teams of mine, but never coached basketball. So once I started playing for him at Tennessee, I think the whole dad thing kind of went away, and I started addressing him as coach or BP.
Okay, so you're working for you're born and your dad's at the University of Iowa. Then did you take the Southern Indiana job? How old were you?
I was 5 years old in 92 when he took the Southern Indiana job, and he was there for 9 years, and then took it up to Milwaukee for his first Division I job, and then took it down to Tennessee in 2005, and then I started playing for him in 2006.
Well, you're skipping ahead, dude. You don't know how we do this, okay? We do kind of the bit-by-bit thing. Like, that's the whole thing.
Piece by piece, okay.
Okay, so Southern Indiana it's in Evansville, isn't it?
Yep, Evansville, Indiana.
Okay, which is hotbed for high school hoops and hotbed for college hoops. Obviously, the Aces haven't been what they used to be. What do you remember kind of about that's like all your formative years, right, up until high school. Your dad's coach at a school, and they're winning national championships, right? They're competing at a high level. What do you remember about growing up in Evansville?
It was really cool growing up in Evansville because, you know, obviously you had the Purple Aces in it, but Southern Indiana, the Screaming Eagles, they were the team that was talked about in town. And, you know, they used to sell out the Pack Arena, which held, you know, 2,500 people. So it was the biggest show in town. And we always try and get Evansville to play us, but they never would. So growing up in that environment was really cool for me. You know, as a kid, Evansville is a great place to grow up. I'm not sure if I'd go back there as an adult. But growing up, you know, had some great memories. Growing up, you know, was really good friends with Preston Mattingly, who's Don Mattingly's son. So, you know, had some really cool memories with that family. But really spent all my time kind of in the gym, with coach every day. I'd go to work with him when I wasn't at school. On the weekends, I'd spend all weekend, at his office, just running around the gym, you know, getting shots up, hanging out, and just bringing my friends out there. So as a kid growing up, it was really cool to kind of have your dad as the head coach of you know, one of the bigger teams in that town. Getting to spend a ton of time with the players, you know, the players kind of adopted me as like a little brother. So that was really special. And some of your best memories growing up, you know, as a coach's kid, revolve around, you know, those teams and those memories, and obviously winning championships and being one of the more successful Division II programs in the country at that time. It was really special.
Okay, so what do you remember about the national championship year was 95, I'm going to say?
Is it 95? I'm thinking,
yeah, 95. Yep. It's funny because, like, one of the reasons I wore 44 was, P. Maravich wore 44, Hank Gathers wore 44, Jerry West wore 44, but also my dad's, like, best player was a guy named Kirk Tagey at UW-Milwaukee. He wore 44. And so I always liked the number. Do you remember who your favorite player was in the 95 team?
Brian Hebner wore number 3. And so I kind of wore number 3 growing up. That changed when I got to college. But, growing up, Brian Hebner was my favorite player, wore number 3 for us. And you know, that 95 team was, you know, really special. The year before, they had made it to the national the national final game, and then lost, finished second. And then the following year, we were playing Cal State Bakersfield in Springfield, and we're down like 23 at halftime. And one of the officials goes over to coach during the game and says, "Coach, you got to get a hold of that kid at the end of your bench. He won't stop crying." And I'm just in tears because we're getting our tails handed to us, and I'm afraid that we're about to lose another national championship. So, you know, at halftime, you know, coach kind of comes over to me in the locker room. He's like, "Buddy, what's wrong?" I was like, "Dad, we're going to lose. You know, we're going to lose again." And then, you know, second half, we come out and, you know, Stan Gerard and you know, some of the guys on the team just rally around, and they find a way to come back and win the national championship. So you remember those years, you know, you're in kindergarten, and to be able to remember those types of things, you know, it's really cool.
In 2001, he got the UW-Milwaukee job. Obviously, you were too young to remember how everything went down at Iowa. I'm sure you became a little bit more aware at Southern Indiana. Like, what was your sense for your dad and why he wasn't a Division I head coach?
I think I was still a little too young to kind of get involved with the specifics in and out of it. I think, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, I've kind of begun to understand the landscape as to why he may have not gotten a job. I know he had interviewed at multiple places. I know he had interviewed at Butler, didn't get that job. But then obviously, you know, getting the job in Milwaukee was kind of just, it was kind of a long time coming because of the success that he had had at Southern Indiana. So, you know, I was still a little too young to really know the ins and outs of it. But it was kind of one of those things where we'd been there for 9 years. I was going into the eighth grade, so as a kid, it was really tough because I had, you know, really some lifelong friends that I'd grown up with. So having to leave Evansville was probably the hardest move as a kid, just because I'd spent my entire childhood there. I had all my memories there. But then, you know, like he kind of explained to me, this is part of the profession, this is part of the job. You know, it was amazing that we were able to stay in Evansville for all those years. You know, at one point in time, he had the opportunity, I think, to get the Middle Tennessee State job when we were at Southern Indiana, and he ended up turning it down because the AD asked him, you know, what are you going to tell your team when you have to tell them that you're leaving? He just broke down and he couldn't do it, so he decided to stay at Southern Indiana. And then I think, you know, Butler was next, interviewed for it, didn't get it, and then interviewed at Milwaukee and decided to take the job. And then, you know, we just had to trust what he told us, and we kind of packed things up and on to Milwaukee we went.
Okay. So now you're more aware, right? Now you're like high school age and you're at UW Milwaukee. What was that like?
Yeah, it was getting up there trying to figure out, you know, what I was going to do for AAU basketball. I was trying to figure out where I was going to go to high school and it was cool. I mean, I'd met some really good friends early. The Grubers, as you know, Steven Gruber was the first guy I met at basketball camp when I first got up there. And, you know, he said, my dad and your dad are going to be really good friends. So they introduced him to David Gruber, who, you know, now Coach and David are really good friends. So, you know, being around it, I was kind of understanding more of what it kind of took to build a program. And kind of watching it kind of evolve in front of me was really cool because I had more of an understanding as far as what were some of the intricacies of what Coach did every day. Now, I obviously didn't understand it as well as I do now, but to kind of see him build programs, you know, watching him do it at Southern Indiana as a kid, but then getting to see it at the high school level, it was pretty cool as being a coach's kid, being like stepping back and like, whoa, you know, my dad's pretty good at this. You know, he's been able to do it at Southern Indiana. They were, you know, national contender every year. Now he's at Milwaukee and we're in the NCAA tournament in year two. And Dylan Page misses a layup against Notre Dame at the very end of the game to send us the second round. And then 2 years later, you know, he takes that team and goes to the Sweet 16 and beats Boston College and Alabama. So to see him kind of build it in 4 years and really, you know, beat, you know, really good teams in the Horizon League like Butler and Illinois Chicago and have those great rivalries and win Horizon League championships. To kind of see it as I'd gotten older, it really gave me a new perspective on how good he was at his job.
Okay, so what is it that he does? Like he has, you know, like I think so many of these guys, and I think most people who are good in their profession have it. It's just an energy about him that he can, even when he's not feeling great, you would never know because he can find a way to dial it up, right? Like if you, and I know you, like part of our travels, not just knowing each other, but you get to meet, you know, movie stars and rock stars and other athletes, and they have this kind of, they have this well of energy that other people just don't have. And so even when they're tired, you're like, damn, how is he, you know? Other than that, though, what is the secret sauce that you've seen him, maybe not old enough to know at Southern Indiana, but at Milwaukee and then Tennessee and now Auburn, that he's able to do to generate success?
Yeah, I think I really started to learn it once I got to Auburn, because as a player at Tennessee, you don't see the day in and day out of a coach and all the things that go into it. But now that I work with him, he just cares so much. He cares, and it's not just like it's more than just the coaching staff and his players. He genuinely cares about the fan base. He genuinely cares about the university. He genuinely cares about other sports on campus. He genuinely cares about, you know, how we're perceived on and off campus. And I think all those things are really important in building a program and building a foundation and building a culture. The amount that his level of care is kind of just off the charts. And I think that's why he puts so much work into it. And I think that's why every community that he's been involved in, you know, in the schools that he's coached, just buy in and they kind of, you know, revolve around him and they come out to support the team. Even when the team's not that good. I mean, we were at Auburn in our first couple of years. We weren't very good. You saw us. But we still, you know, had great home crowds. We still had great student turnout. So it just matters to him, you know, to be able to touch all those pieces and to be able to make, you know, the university proud. He puts so much effort into it because it matters to him. It really does matter. It's not just the on-the-court stuff. It's everything off the court that's needed to kind of build a, you know, to build a program that wasn't in the greatest spot. So I think that's the biggest thing is just, you know, how much it matters to him personally, and all the people that, you know, the athletic directors that took the chance on him. Like he feels, you know, he's in debt to them and he has to reward them. So he works, you know, he always says he's not the most talented guy in the world, but he's going to work harder than everyone else. And he's kind of had that mindset, you know, every single day. And you talk about his energy. You know, Coach Flanagan, one of our assistant coaches, went out recruiting with him last week after we just got back from the Final Four, and he's like, man, I don't know how he does it. You know, we're going for three straight days recruiting, and he's just high level, high energy the entire time. And it's not an act. That's just who he is, and he's able to kind of do that everywhere he goes. And it's kind of just translated into being able to turn these programs around into, you know, winning environments.
Okay, so you get to Tennessee. You guys take Milwaukee to the Sweet 16, and you go to Tennessee. You're coming up, I think, on your senior year in high school.
Yep.
What do you remember about the move to Tennessee?
Initially, I told him I wasn't leaving Milwaukee. I was like, I want to stay and play my final year of high school ball up here. And he said, well, I'm not going, you know, without you. And I was like, all right, well, so that kind of... that ends that conversation because I wasn't going to stop him from, you know, making the biggest move and transition of his coaching career to go from Milwaukee to Tennessee. So, you know, just like when we moved from Evansville to Milwaukee, had a ton of really good friends that I didn't want to break ties with. And then moving down to a new place, you know, for your senior season, that's tough because, you know, you obviously put a ton of time in, you know, with your teammates over 3 years in high school. So it was a tough move, but obviously it made sense because you're in the SEC. Tennessee's a good program with some tradition, an incredible fan base, you know, all the different things that it takes to be successful. So we go down there and, you know, obviously while I'm trying to, you know, find new friends and figure out what I'm doing with basketball, you know, just to kind of watch, you know, what there was at Tennessee. You know, Buzz Peterson left a really good team. You had C.J. Watson, you had Chris Lofton, Juwan Smith, Major Wingate, Dane Bradshaw. You had some really good pieces, and what we did just kind of fit that team perfectly. You know, it looked very similar to some of the teams we've had the last couple of years, undersized guys that shoot the crap out of the ball and want to play fast. So that first year, you know, we got 22 and – I think 9, get a 2 seed in the NCAA tournament, win the SEC East, and, you know, had success right away. And then from there, it was just a snowball effect. Every single year we go to the Sweet 16. The next year I come in as a freshman. I'm a redshirt. And then just to kind of see it over time build and, you know, spending 5 years there as a player, redshirting my first year. And I'm sure we'll get into the playing part of it. But, you know, to kind of see what he was able to accomplish there, being a national contender, being a contender in the SEC every year with, you know, Kentucky and Florida and Vanderbilt and, you know, some in Mississippi State, LSU, to kind of do it against the elite was, you know, it was really cool.
Okay. So, you play your senior year. Was there ever a thought you weren't going to play for your dad?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I was getting some low major interest, some Ivy League interest, a lot of Division II interest. It was All-State in Tennessee, averaged 25 points a game in high school. So obviously, I had some options out there, but at the end of the day, I thought it was, obviously I'm one of those guys that's always got a chip on their shoulder and always trying to prove something. And everyone always told me there's no way you'll ever play at Tennessee. There's no way. So I took that as a challenge. And after weighing a lot of, different options, I, decided I wanted to go to Tennessee, walk on, and try and find a way to play. So, there was definitely some thought early. But, me, I'm always up for a challenge. So once everyone told me there was, no way you'd play at this level, that kind of made me want to do it even more.
Okay, so you arrive, it's 2007. It's your dad's second year, right?
Yep.
And I just can't imagine, it's hard enough to be a walk-on and then to be the coach's kid and he's trying to turn around. And you're trying to, earn respect. You're also trying to figure out college, because even though you spent a year in a college town, it's completely different once you're in the school. Mm-hmm. What was that process like? And how did the guys, in all honesty, how did they treat you?
Yeah, it was, we signed a ridiculous class that first year. You had, it was like a top 10 class with Wayne Chisholm, Duke Cruz, Ramar Smith, Marcus Johnson, and Josh Tabb. So it was a nationally highly rated class. And we all kind of came in, together, because I kind of helped recruit those guys, because, when they'd be on their visits, I was there. So we did all kind of come in at the same time, as a group, and, they treated me like I'd been recruited the same way they did. I'd been around the program the year before when I was in high school. So all those guys that were returners that following year, obviously all knew me, but, they just treated me, like anyone else, because, quite frankly, coach treated me worse than any of them. So they knew I wasn't getting any preferential treatment. So it was just like I was, one of the guys out there, and, treated me, just like any other incoming freshman. But also with the whole walk-on tag, they gave me a little, a little extra crap, like most walk-ons do. You had to do some of the extra stuff that you never want to do, but kind of have to do as a walk-on. So there was never anything, it wasn't difficult, coming in as a freshman walk-on, and being the coach's kid. They kind of, my team did a really good job of kind of seeing past all that and not, having it ever be an issue.
Yeah, that was the year that you guys went 31-5, right?
No, the next year we went 31-5. That year we went 24-12 or something. Went to the Sweet 16, lost to Greg Oden, Mike Conley in the Sweet 16. We were up 19 at half, I think, and then they shot 34 free throws in the second half and kind of came back and ended up winning the game.
Okay, I wouldn't be doing my job as much as, and you and I have, I don't know if you know this, we've never talked about not just the barbecue, but people don't remember how things went down. Here's my recollection of kind of what happened with everything, right? Not yep. necessarily the it's that, okay, so what year did we go to? It was Israel. Israel was my son. It was 2010. So yep. 2009, yep. BP calls me and he's like, hey, I'm going to Israel in a year. I'm going to coach the Maccabi team. I want you to be my assistant. Why don't you come with me? And I was like, done, in. Okay?
Yeah.
And I didn't know, so you have to kind of commit a year in advance. And we had, I'm going to say, didn't we have a tryout, weekend in Knoxville? Yeah, I think that.
We did.
Okay. So, yep. so, and this is my recollection of it. So the practice facility was sick, and I had never... I hadn't been to Knoxville since my senior year in high school. I played in some all-star game at the arena and, yep. We went out that night. That's the only time I'd ever been to Knoxville. So, we yep. stay at your dad's new house, which he had was just moving into, was just finished off or whatever. But the basement, yep. I stayed in the basement and he had a poker room that was with vented parts of the ceiling. So you could smoke in the poker room or whatever. And we had a couple days of workouts and I was like, this motherfucker can coach. I had never been, yeah. I never liked the style of flex or cutters, whatever offense, but I watched and I was like, this fucking dude can coach. And, yeah. And we had a great time. And then I don't know if you remember, my flight was earlier than everybody else's. I had to get back and we were on a boat. He got a free boat every
That's
year,
right?
Yeah,
he got a boat every year as part of his deal. He did like speaking engagements for Sea Ray, and they kind of let him use a boat in the summer. So we had a couple boats out there, and I think someone had to come get you on a jet ski to take you back so you can get to the airport.
Correct. I literally had like a bag and like a jet, and I had a bag. He's like, just throw on the boat. We'll take you to the airport. I was like, how are you going to do it? Don't worry about it. We'll figure it out, right? So we got a bunch of guys, and we're throwing back some beers, and guys are water skiing and jet skiing, and we're tying up the boat. Then I'm like, shit, I got to go get to the airport. He's like, no problem. He's like, hey, can anybody take him to the airport? Some guy pulls up on a jet ski, like, hey, I'll take him over there. And like, it was literally it was like the most country shit everywhere. I grab my bag, I hop in the back of a jet ski with like, you know, no shirt on and flip flops, takes me over to like, you know, like a Trans Am, hop in the Trans Am and some random dude, like,
no idea
we go down
the
a back.
No idea on a jet ski either.
Yes. And, you know, they pass me off to guy, and I get dropped off at the airport. I'm like, later. So somewhere in the, I don't remember what month of the year that was. I'm going to say that felt like August. So my wife at the time had just gotten pregnant. If I find the guy, let me know. Anyway, so I didn't think anything of going to Israel. The next summer, so we had Hayes, your dude Hayes, in March, and I was like, she'll be fine. Like, I'm going to Israel a couple of months, so like, no big deal. And then right as it came time to booking time, my wife's like, no way you're going to Israel while I have three kids, three and under. Like, that's just not happening.
Not happening.
So I came and helped with the workouts at George Washington, right? And again, I was like, this fucking dude can coach. And he let me do so much. It was awesome. He's like, you don't like that? Here, change it. Do it. And then while you guys were gone, that's when Aaron Kraft decommitted, right? Wasn't it while you were in Israel? He was gone for like the whole month of July and missed that recruiting period. Is that accurate?
Yeah, he was gone that entire month. And yeah, I think that's when it all happened. There was a couple things going on back home, with recruiting. And I just remember, after we won the gold medal in overtime, you know, BP was basically, came in the locker room, gave us, one of the most memorable speeches that we'll ever hear, that we can talk about in private one day. And then basically just bolted out. And went straight to the airport, jumped on a plane, and flew back to the United States to try and, you know, fix some of the situations that were going on in recruiting because he had been gone that entire month.
Wait, why can't we talk about the what is because he cursed or because he was talking about what it means to be a Jew or what was it?
No,
because when we won it, I'll just give you my personal experience. So I coached 2 years ago, and you know, truth be told, like. Look, we go over there, and I had never been, you know, like, the deal with, for people who don't know the Maccabi game, so it's like the Jewish Olympics. And I went over there when I was in between, right before I had started at Notre Dame, at Oklahoma State. So I had played a year of college basketball, sat out a year. And, why am I forgetting what, Herb Brown's our coach. And we beat a team in the pool play by 60. And then we played in the semifinals and shit, we got beat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of those deals. We were playing too many guys. And I don't think Herb really understood what he had or how to play. And I just remember like, and then we won the silver medal against the Israeli team who also got upset. But the Americans and the Israelis are supposed to play in the championship game. And, You're supposedly have the best players. The problem is that, you know, if you're really, really good and you're Jewish, you know, you're thinking about either playing the NBA or already playing in Israel and you've been there 10 months and you want to come home, it's like a little bit harder. So you're playing with kids, sometimes against men, whatever. And there's the pressure of it. You don't get any calls. So we played France in the championship game. We stomped Israel. I felt like they played too young a team and we were really playing well. And we were up like 20 and it got tight. I think we won by 6 at the end. And so I also, like BP, I got on a plane that night because I had to come back and work. And I've been, you know, like you're gone like a month. And I loved it. But my post-game speech was more I went through every guy because I didn't play every guy in the championship game. I felt a little bad about it. But I would have felt a lot worse had we lost. You guys won on like a last-second shot, didn't you?
Well, we were down 8 with like 2 minutes left. And basically, like we just BP like gave us 4 just ridiculous play calls, a couple back doors and a couple play calls for shots, and we ended up tying it. you know, I think Seth Halpin made a layup with like 5 seconds left to tie it up, and then we go to overtime. We just spank him in overtime and end up winning the gold medal. And it was, I mean, at the point when we were down 8, it was not looking good. And for us to be able to come back, and, you know, BP always makes a joke, when you had Isaac, Joseph, and Jacob as the 3 referees, your chances of winning in Israel weren't looking very good. And, you know, weren't getting calls the entire game. We're just getting screwed the entire time, and just kind of found a way to hang in there. And then in overtime, we kind of got hot, and they just couldn't take it away from us. And, you know, we ended up winning and really celebrating. And, you know, we all went out that night and saw the Israeli players at their, like, the club they always go to in Tel Aviv. And it was, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you, all this stuff is going down in recruiting. You're in Israel. Like, did you have any idea? Did any of this, did you guys know any of this stuff was going down? You, like, you personally, as a member of Tennessee's basketball team?
No, not at all, really. I mean, I just knew that BP, something had gone wrong with, you know, one or two of his verbal commitments. I think Josh Selby, yep, the kid that went to Kansas was the other one. So something had kind of gone astray with both of those. I guess Kansas had gotten involved and kind of, you know, was messing with a little bit. And so I know he had to get back to kind of get in front of both those guys just to kind of see what was going on, because, like you said, he was gone that entire month. But as a member of the team, like, you know, minus, like, when kids would come in on visits, like, we, you know, didn't follow recruiting as much. It wasn't as, like, all over social media, because social media wasn't, like, Twitter just started back then. So it wasn't, like, as all over the place as it is now and as easy to find. We just, you know, when coaches told us we had to host, you know, we hosted. But besides that, we didn't really have as much information on recruiting as kids do now.
So what was it like to, like, there's all this different part. One, you're part of the team, and he's in limbo, his last year in Tennessee.
Yeah.
But two, you're also his son, right? And and like, look, like, again, those of us who know him know that BP is not what I think some people will always negatively perceive him to be. What was that like? What was that experience like for you?
At the end or just in general?
In general.
In general, you know, just leading up to it. I mean, you obviously, you know, being a coach's kid as well, like, you get this probably all the time. You know, people always, you know, doubted why you played. And I always tell people, you know, I probably should have been playing a year earlier, but coach, you know, put other guys ahead of me just because he didn't want people to think that he was giving me any preferential treatment. And we had some knockdown just fights over it, you know, in practice, just going back and forth. And obviously when I wasn't playing, like, there was a little bit of a strain in our relationship because I was a stubborn kid. And he was just, you know, a father and a coach trying to do what was best for me and what was best for the team. So he was in an incredibly difficult situation. But then, obviously, in my junior year, you know, some things happened. I was able to kind of get into the rotation. And, you know, we go out there and have a great year. You know, we beat number one Kansas at home, my second game in the rotation. And then we go on to have a pretty good SEC season. We go to an Elite Eight. We're 1 point away from the Final Four, you know, to play Butler in the Final Four. And we lose by one to Michigan State, Draymond Green and Corey Lucius and those guys. And then the next year, all the stuff happens with the NCAA and with the barbecue, and it's all kind of just like a cloud hanging over our heads. So to play for him that year, it was tough. You know, there was a lot of outside noise and, you know, not really knowing what was going to happen. And then he was suspended for 8 games, you know, and to kind of see the wear and tear that kind of took on him was tough, you know, obviously as a player, but then as his son was incredibly difficult because obviously you know how much time and how much effort he puts into his job, and to kind of see it falling apart there at the end was brutal. To be honest, it was brutal. And then, you know, we go to the NCAA tournament and get blown out by Michigan. The end was difficult. And it was really hard kind of seeing him in that stage. You know, he never brought it to work, though. He was always, you know, composed and positive, and he was himself when he was around us and around the coaches and around the team. But just outside of that, I could kind of see, you know, what it was doing to him. And, yeah, like the one word for it was brutal having to go through that.
Okay, so did you know? Do you know he's going to get fired?
No, I didn't really know. Didn't know until we were on the bus heading to Charlotte for the game, and they had like put out a quote from the AD, you know, basically like that he was unsure of his future, and that's when it first clicked to me, like, oh shit, this is not going to end well. Unless we just, went to the Final Four or something, because winning does, miraculous things, but that obviously didn't happen. So I really didn't know he was getting fired until we were kind of heading to the game, to play Michigan. I really had no idea.
Okay. So like that's gotta just be weird for you considering you're a Tennessee alum. You played basketball at Tennessee. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you loved most of your time there. On the other hand, like, they fired your dad, and it's not that he didn't make mistakes, but he did own the, I just always felt like it was double jeopardy. Like, all right, you spend him eight games, like, that's the penalty. Like, spend him eight games, you let him coach the season, then you fire him. When you already spend him eight, like, what was the whole point of the thing? How does it sit with you today? Forget about him. How does it sit with you today as a Tennessee alum?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously difficult, but at the same time, you got to realize that the people that made those decisions aren't there anymore. Philip Fulmer is a really good friend of our family's. He's the athletics director there, and obviously, like, have nothing but love for him and his family, and tons of respect for Coach Barnes. But I'd be lying if I said it didn't. It still didn't sting a little bit. Just thinking back on it. But then you got to, like I said, you got to try and put it in perspective and realize that a lot of the people that, did make those decisions, aren't there. But at the same time, like, if they hadn't made those decisions, we may not have ended up at Auburn and we went to a Final Four this year. So, I mean, at the end of the day, like, it's really all worked out. It's all worked out well for them. They're in a great place with for a while they weren't in a great place. But I think they found their guy in Coach Barnes, and, he obviously was co-champions of the SEC last year, and then made it to a Sweet 16 this year. So they're in a good spot, and I think we're in a great spot being at Auburn. And looking back on it, if you had told me back then you'd end up in 2019 at Auburn and you'd just come up the Final Four, obviously you would have taken it instantly, having to deal with 3 years where we weren't in coaching. I feel like it's all worked out well. There was definitely some bitterness there. The Tennessee fan base was always a huge, very supportive of Coach and what he was all about. And that never changed. But it's all kind of worked out for the better. And I think we're all in a better place because of it.
Do you have any of your Tennessee gear?
I do. I still have my jerseys. Still haven't gotten my Letterman's jacket, though. So if anyone at Tennessee hears this, I've been waiting on a Letterman's jacket for like 5 or 6 years now, and it's never gotten shipped to me. So if we could remedy that situation, I wouldn't mind having that one day for my kids to see.
Yeah. No, listen, I had mine. I never got one in high school. I was cheesy in high school, and I had one in college, and they were kind of cool. I have my Notre Dame one still, which I haven't really rocked, obviously. Still a little awkward. But I had an Oklahoma State one that was stolen. And like it was like the worst game ever. We played OU on the road. We had beaten them my sophomore year, my junior year, and we were just terrible. I was personally awful. And I got my Letterman jacket stolen from the locker room during the game. I did
just
get one a couple
injury.
Of Yes, I did get one, and I do have it, so I feel you on that. Okay. What did you do when BP went to TV? What did you do?
I did medical sales. I went and worked for Stryker in Tennessee. Ron Barzak and Darren Way were my bosses. And it was something I'd kind of worked on while I was still at Tennessee because, I had a chance to go play professionally overseas. But also at the same time, I had to kind of be realistic that I wasn't going to be the most prolific star overseas, and it probably wouldn't have turned into much for me, so I had to kind of make a grown-up decision as far as what I was going to do. Coach had just gotten fired, so I was like trying to figure out what my next step was, and I kind of wanted to get into something right away to kind of buy my time and to have myself stay busy doing something. And I had kind of built a relationship with Ron and Darren while I was a senior at Tennessee. And they had basically told me, like, whenever you finish, you know, this job could open up, so you got to be ready. And, once we finished up in the tournament, I was in grad school. A couple weeks later, Ron calls me and says, hey, the position's open. It's yours if you want it, but it's going to fill quickly. So drop out of grad school and jumped right into medical sales and did that for 3.5 years covering.
What were you selling?
Hospitals and surgery centers in East Tennessee and Southwest Virginia.
What medical devices?
I was selling saws and drills and a lot of different pieces of equipment that did like total joint surgery, so total knees, total hips, total shoulders. So saws, drills, cement mixers, tourniquets, all types of different things for orthopedic surgeries.
What was the gnarliest surgery that you had to sit in on?
Man, I had to do some, we had a certain product that like stopped bleeding. So I had to do some like OBGYN procedures. And the amount of respect I have for women now, having to go through some of that stuff, it's incredible. It was, I don't know if you'd call it gnarly, but it was not fun, but it was quite the experience.
Okay. So you make good coin, right? You're taking doctors out to eat, right? The hours are a little trying, whatever, but things could be rougher for a recent college graduate.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
Okay, so I always thought that your dad, and look, I left ESPN right before he joined ESPN.
Yeah.
And your dad's one of those guys that should have been a superstar, right? Should have been Al McGuire.
Yeah.
I don't ever think he was able to be comfortable enough. Like you know what I mean? It's like Seth Greenberg is very good and he was always good to your dad. And like, but I, for whatever reason, like the two Jews, I don't know why I never felt like they found the right guys with him to make it sing. Is that fair?
Yeah. I think part of that is that, but then I think the other part of it is, I think once he started doing TV, I think he started itching to get back into it even more just because he got around it again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, listen, if you do, I tell you, like when Urban Meyer did the games when he was at ESPN, I told everybody, like, yeah, he's going to coach again. Like if you do the game, if you do the studio, it's kind of, I like it because you feel like you can watch every game, but it's not the same. Whereas you do a game and you really prep for it, you watch tape, you talk to the coaches, you sit there and watch film with them, you watch practice, you're like, dude, I miss it. I miss, you even miss the losing as much as miss the winning.
And I know exactly what he was doing. Like he's sitting there covering games and he's at practice. He's writing shit down like, oh, this will be good for what we do. You know, like he's sitting there taking notes for if he ever got back into coaching, what would work, what wouldn't work. And I think he learned so much in those couple of years when he was working with ESPN, watching film, watching other teams. Cause when you're in it and you're a coach, you spend so much time on your team that you don't, unless you really make a concerted effort to get out there during the summer and go sit down with other teams, which we do a pretty good job of, you don't get a ton of time to kind of add to it. Cause you're so busy doing a million different things. He had those 3 years to kind of refine his craft and make what he did better. And like you said, I think being around practices, being around the kids, the ins and outs, the intricacies of what you do every day, I think it made him miss it even more. So I think getting back into TV was, I mean, a major reason as to why he got back into coaching.
Okay, so did he call you first and say he was taking the Auburn job? Like, how'd the Auburn thing go down in terms of your knowledge of it?
So we were heading down. It was me, BP, and then my buddy Jordan Howell, who played with me at Tennessee. We were actually driving down to Atlanta. I think Coach had something going on in Atlanta, and then we just wanted to go down there to watch the SEC tournament. We were going down, to support Tennessee. So we were going down to watch the games, and Jordan is from Auburn, Alabama, originally. His mom still lives there. His brother played at Auburn. Jordan was recruited by Georgia, Auburn, Alabama, and Tennessee. Ended up going to Tennessee. So Jordan was around in Auburn when, you had Chris Porter and the Cliff Ellis days. So, like, he was around when Auburn was last really good. So we're in the car, and, you know, you obviously hear the rumors circulating that Tony Barbee, you know, is going to get fired at the end of the year. And BT is in the car and just flat out says to Jordan, he says, you know, Jordan, can Auburn win in basketball? And Jordan was like, honestly, BT, like, I was there, you know, in the early 90s when it was really good, and I feel like if you were there, yeah, they can win again. And that's kind of really how it all started, at least how I remember it getting started. And then over the next couple of days, you know, things really started to pick up as far as discussions between, you know, Jay Jacobs, David Benedict, and Coach. And that's kind of where it all got started. And then they came up and visited with us in his kitchen, sat back, drank a few beers, talked about it. And, you know, Coach obviously wanted to make sure that, you know, before he did anything, that Brandy and, you know, the rest of his kids were good with it. And I think my siblings were more excited about getting back into coaching than he actually was. He was excited, but my sisters and my little brother, you know, they eat it up and they love it. And they just, you know, they live for going to games and going to tournaments. And, you know, so they were obviously really excited about it. And I think that made his decision that much easier.
Okay, so did he immediately go like, "Hey, you're coming with me"? I mean, what was the conversation like when mm-hmm. you when he took the job as far as you working for him?
So, I was kind of in a transition period with my job. I was about to kind of get interviewed to be in my own territory, you know, if I had earned one. So I was kind of, you know, looking to relocate at that time anyway. And then the opportunity came about, and I was kind of itching to get back into it anyway. I was doing a Saturday morning radio show, in Knoxville. So I was, you know, just kind of getting back involved in the sports thing. And, you know, I was 26 at the time, so I was still young enough to kind of switch professions and still be able to get back into medical sales if I really wanted to. So we talked about it, and he was like, you know, I was like, you know, what would you think about us kind of doing this thing together? He said, you know, obviously I'd love for you to be there with me. Yeah, I trust you. You know, you're gonna be good at this. If you do it, you know, you just got to understand that you're gonna have to work for everything you get. Like, I'm not just gonna hand you an assistant coaching position, you know, just because you're my son and we get down to Auburn. So, very similar to how it was when I played for him. You know, we talked about doing it together, building it together. You know, knowing that it was gonna take some time. And you know this with your dad and with your brother. You know, some of your most important accomplishments in life, you know, when you get to do them with your family, they make them that much more special. So for us to be able to kind of go down there and do it together, you know, it was pretty cool. And I got a quick reality check very quickly when I got down there, and my role was the assistant strength coach, and I was making not a lot of money.
How much are you making your first year?
Probably 50 or 60 maybe. So it took a pretty big pay cut from doing medical sales to go down there and kind of start working at Auburn. You know, so I worked as an assistant strength coach for a year, did operations for 2 years, and then now I'm in my second year as a full-time assistant coach.
And you kind of become like his right-hand guy, right? Like you do the defense, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, had a big part of kind of building our defense last year, and just a ton of like in-game adjustments, just trying to help him manage the game. The coolest part about working for him, and this goes for anyone on our staff, is he is open to any and all suggestions. Just like when you were coaching us when we were getting ready for the Maccabi games, like if you had something that you wanted to run with, like he will let you do it. So last year when we were kind of going through everything and we were down to, you know, three guys on the staff, you know, or for 3 to 5 guys on the staff, it really made a lot of us have to step up and you know, have bigger roles in what we were doing. So I took over the defense. You know, Chad Pruitt and Mike Burgomaster helped out with the offense, you know, and Harris just kind of oversaw everything. He was, you know, he just kind of helped out with in every single area. So I was kind of able to have more of a voice defensively last year, on this team, and it's kind of carried over into this year with Coach Flanagan. So yeah, just, you know, I feel like, you know, we have a really good dialogue. You know, I'm able to say things to him that no one else in the staff's able to say to him. So I think that's good for our staff to be able to bounce things off of me, because I'll be able to know how Coach will react to certain things, and you know, he lets me get away with a little bit more just because we have a little bit of a tighter relationship. But it's very healthy. It's, you know, obviously been a ton of fun, and to kind of do what we were able to do this year was it was a blast.
But it is interesting how you're able to do what you're able to do. Like, you know, Mustafa Heron transfers. Yep. You know, the Chuck Person thing obviously is still kind of looming, right? Harris Adler decides to get out of basketball and go work back in Philly. And, you know, that was, a personal decision that's been written about. Like, Harris is an awesome dude. And so, like, if you're outside the program, you're like, man, this could be really bad. How did it come together to be the opposite and be really good?
I just think the culture that we've built with our kids is just so strong right now. You know, we have so many high character kids in that locker room that, you know, even when something really bad happens, they're able to kind of bind together and fight through it. You look at what happened last year with, you know, everything with during the season, you know, having to lose a few staff members. You know, we end up coming together. That team wins an SEC championship and goes to the tournament for the first time since 2003. And this year, you know, you got Mustafa Heron transfers. You have Deshaun Murray transfers. You have Davion Mitchell transferring. You lose three of your top, you know, eight or nine guys. And then, you know, we just bring in new players. Guys that had lesser roles last year had to step up. And we end up coming together, winning 12 or 13 straight at the end of the year, and then going to a Final Four. And then on top of that, we beat North Carolina, and our best player tears his ACL in the game. And then we got to go play Kentucky, who had just beaten us by 30 back in February. And those guys come together and win. So I think it's a huge testament to the culture that BP has built. It's a resilient locker room. It's a resilient group of kids. And, you know, it's such a family atmosphere that when something like, you know, what's happened over, you know, a couple different instances has happened, it kind of brings our guys closer together and we kind of play for each other.
Okay. So how do you, what is the secret to the culture? How do you build it? What is it? You guys have team building things. Do you have things that you have to do every day? Is there living arrangement things? Like, what's different about Auburn from every other school that allows you guys to have a better culture than most other schools, in your opinion?
I think it's the trust and the freedom that BP has and gives to his players. You know, some people will criticize us because of the shots that we take, but the reason that they're able to take those shots is because BP lets them. And in return, that makes them want to do everything for him in return. You know, if you're allowed to play with tremendous freedom offensively, the guys are going to, you know, they're going to guard for you. They're going to rebound for you. They're going to go to class for you. They're going to do community service. They're going to do things that, you know, other players may not do because they know that their coach trusts them. So I think the fact that coach has tremendous trust in his players and gives them tremendous freedom, you know, makes them kind of fight for him. And then on top of that, just having good kids in that locker room, they've all kind of binded together as a really, you know, as a good group of friends. Obviously winning helps a lot of those things, but I think the culture that was built, you know, on that trust and on that freedom, has really made it as a healthy environment and, has really shown off over the last 2 years.
Okay, so you mentioned like all the things that you guys had going at the end, right? When Chuma ends up tearing his ACL, right? But you also have, you know, Wiley struggles to practice all the time, right? Because of his body, and you know he's had some things, and you know it's kind of a, you know, you guys always play a difficult schedule. The SEC has gotten really, really good. That's what happens when you hire really good coaches throughout the league. They get very good, you know, you get good players and teams get super invested in it. Was there a moment this year where you felt like, because you did, like one time you played Kentucky, you got run out of the building, right? So was there a moment where you're like, okay, this is different?
Yeah, I mean, at that point we were 7-7, like 18-8. But we always knew that with this team's ability to shoot the ball, and just I don't know if this is even a word, Doug, but we called it, our spurt ability was better than anyone's in the country. We could run off a 12 or 13 point run on people in a matter of seconds. So our ability to do that, you know, still gave us a chance to be dangerous. You know, like you said, Austin was injured in and out during the year. You know, Chuma had gone through a slump early in the season. You know, still guys were still trying to figure out their roles because we had 10 or 11 guys that were all capable of starting. So I think the biggest thing is once we started winning at the end of the year and started finding ways to win, guys started buying into their roles a little, you know, more willingly. And I think it made everything click. And then on top of that, you know, everyone was shooting the ball at a pretty high level. So when you're able to make shots,
you know, you're able to fly around defensively, make plays, it just makes, you know, it makes winning a lot easier. And it just, everything kind of gelled at the right moment, because I think the biggest thing was the kids all kind of came together and said, listen, we could either, you know, go to a Final Four, or we could be in the first four and lose or miss the tournament. And I think they, as a unit, kind of got together and made a conscious decision to accept their roles, do what needed to be done to win. And I think that made the difference in everything.
Take me to the Final Four. You're up four. You're up four. And they have the basketball. Now, Kyle Guy hit a tough shot. I was thinking in my head, maybe you start fouling now. Right. And again, and this is, it sounds like hindsight on a podcast, but I did think maybe, and I didn't even realize how many fouls you had to give, but I almost feel like when you're up four, the only way you lose is if there has to be a three, in order to beat you. End up being, you know, essentially two threes. One was three made free throws. You're up four. What do you remember thinking?
Yeah. I mean, like you said, hindsight's everything. You can sit here and think about it a million times, but you know, our primary thing was, you know, our 56% free throw shooter at the line making free throws. You know, quite frankly, like, you know, Anthony made those free throws last year. He hadn't shot them very well this year, so we were hoping he'd make the free throws first. Secondly, we only had one timeout at the time, so we didn't want to call it and burn our last timeout to set up our defense, because we, you know, thought we had been playing pretty good defense up to that point. And we didn't want to tell them live ball as we were shooting free throws, you know, in the middle of the game to foul, because we didn't want it to get confused and kind of lost, just from what I remember. And then, like you said, like, that's probably a 10 or 15%, you know, made shot that he shot in that corner. You know, Samir had a good contest on it. He's twisting and turning out of bounds. So, I mean, you know, you can look back and say we should have fouled. We only had four fouls at the time, so we could have definitely milked some time off the clock. But, you know, we made him shoot a tough contested shot falling out of bounds in the corner. You know, as a coach, you know, you got to live with that. That's, you know, it's a lower percentage shot than him going to the line and making two free throws, cutting it to two. And then, you know, you looked at the end of the New Mexico State game, you know, when we basically kicked the ball out of the gym the last 50 seconds of the game, like that could have happened again. So we felt pretty good about our defense and how we were guarding them at the time. So up four, you know, we wanted to make them shoot a tough contested shot, and they did. And, you know, Kyle Guy made a hell of a play. So you had to give him a lot of credit.
Okay. So, Jared gets the ball and, look, he's a very good free throw shooter. And I'm trying to think, did he make free throws or a jump shot to win the state championship? I think it was his junior year. I remember covering you guys like his freshman year, and you were like, this kid's a stud.
I just felt like free throws.
Yeah, okay. So, like, here's a guy, and granted, it's a little bit bigger stage. By the way, what's it like with all this stuff? It's so much different. You know, you were the one guy that would stand up and get kind of on the stage, but how difficult is it, the coaching, and how different to relay things to your team when you're down, you know, a whole, you know, a yard below the level of the playing surface as opposed to BP, like in terms of communication, and what's the difference there like as opposed to at other times in the year?
Unless you step on the floor, they can't hear a word you're saying. So it's you basically just have a front row seat to a Final Four game if you're an assistant coach. Now, if you find some opportunity to jump out there, like during free throws, to kind of communicate things, you can. But in live ball, like there's no communication with any of the assistants. So anything that we had to relay to coach to kind of relate to our guys, and get the message out there to them on the floor. Because when you're that far back and, you know, it's that open of a space, there was really no communicating with the guys unless it was during timeouts or during dead balls.
So he misses, and obviously you guys start to kind of process of fouling. Did you see, your dad has said he didn't see the double dribble. Did you see the double dribble?
Yeah, I saw it take off his foot. I wasn't sure if Bryce had touched it or not, because no, Bryce was trying to foul him. I did see him pick it up and put it back down, and I did scream it out. But, you know, I said it in an interview, it's a bang-bang play. You know, it's hard to kind of see that at that moment. He may have been looking to see if Bryce was fouling him and just missed it. But definitely from my angle, I saw Jerome pick up the ball and put it back down. You know,
and thinking that it was a double dribble at the time. But, you know, it's just, it happened so fast that, you know, it could have been pretty easy to miss.
It is one of those things, and again, this is all hindsight, but it is one of those things when the other team thinks assumes you're going to foul. Like, he ended up taking, you know, a half-court heave, right?
Yep.
You almost feel like, man, could you design a call that signifies you act like you're going to foul, but you don't actually foul, which will entice them to take a terrible shot, right? Is that something you think maybe in the future teams could practice and put in?
You could, and you just have to have, you know, incredible trust in your kids to not do it, and then also hope that the referee doesn't, you know, kind of blow the call a little bit early, thinking that you were trying to foul. So that's a tough one. But, you know, we had told Bryce to foul. Now, when Jerome had kicked the ball and he had picked it back up, would it have been great if Bryce didn't foul him at all and made him take a tough shot after that? Yeah, but Bryce was just following instructions from his coaches, and we told him to foul, so he fouled, and then they got the side out of bounds play.
So they're running the side out of bounds play. You've poured over all the different tape, right? You've done watching the tape and watching Synergy. Did you know what was coming?
Yep. Yeah, we told we're on the dry erase board, and you know, we talked about it outside of that breakfast spot the other morning. We told our inbound defender, do not let them pass the ball to the corner. But the one thing that I didn't see live ball, and that I saw as I looked back at it, he was able to take like five steps back. So it really didn't matter if you had someone on the ball. His angle to that pass in the corner, there was unless our guy was standing out of bounds, which would have been a violation, there was no way to defend that pass to the corner because of how big the playing surface was. So he was able to get a very clean pass to the corner because he backed up, made a really smart play, and I'm sure Coach Bennett told him to do this. Back up.
Yeah.
And we talked about switching everything.
So in hindsight, with that little of time remaining, knowing now that, like, again, Final Four floor, and for, you know, like, guys listening to this podcast know it's your basketball guys. So, like, if you're lined up in a regular game, there's no space, right? They can tell you to back up, but as long as you don't cross over the line, we've seen games at Kansas like this where there's no space, there's nowhere to see. And like Austin Wiley's a big dude. That's a really hard pass, no matter how, and you want to put a good passer there. So oftentimes they're not a big guy, but because the Final Four playing surface is so large, he can back way up and he has a clear. So again, in hindsight now, for a Final Four, when you have that type of space, do you play in front of him and then play Wiley, you know, guarding the rim, guarding over the back, and make him throw the ball over the top? Is that, like, if you could do it all over again, how would you do it?
Yeah, in hindsight, knowing what we know now, you'd probably put a guard on the ball just in case he, like, throws it to someone and gets a hand back for a shot, because I was kind of concerned with Austin on the ball that they could have gotten a shot for Jerome. And as a five-man, he may not have recognized to do that. And, you know, just hindsight, I would have, you know, put just matched up normally, put Austin at the rim, because if the lob was actually open, I wish he would have thrown it so we could have gone to overtime. But he didn't throw it. And then Kyle Guy, you know, we were supposed to switch that screen, but Samir, you know, we gave him the ability to stay with him, and Samir stays with him. And obviously, you know, everyone knows what happens in the corner. But, you know, if you could do it all over again, obviously you would match up a little differently, knowing that you can't really deflect that corner pass.
Here's a tough question to answer. Let's say he missed the third free throw, okay, and gave you guys new life. I'm just wondering what that huddle was like when you called timeout before the third free throw, whether there was I've talked to Bill about this, and Kansas talked about it, you know, back at the time when they came back and tied the game to beat Memphis in the national championship game. They walked over to the bench and they were like, it's over, right? Because you have the game won, and then all of a sudden now you're going to overtime. They were like, it's over. Obviously, that wasn't even the case with Virginia in the championship game, despite the fact that kind of a sort of similar situation, right? They're up three. Texas Tech actually had the lead in overtime and kind of had a little bit of control there. But I'm just wondering if you thought that it was so devastating to be that, because I'm sitting, you know, 13, 14 rows back, and I thought it was over. Like, I'm like, where's the celebration? Like, oh, because the foul was on the opposite side. I can't imagine trying to figure out, get your balance, and then go and play overtime. What do you think you guys would have been like in overtime?
I think we've been pretty good. You know, we had a similar situation in the Kentucky game when, you know, Bryce didn't give the ball to his point guard, and then Horace dribbles it down, and, you know, Horace shoots the shot to try and win the game. So obviously I'm a little upset that we could have won the game in regulation. But they, you know, they gathered, they got together, and, you know, they still found a way to win that game in overtime by 7 or 8 points. So I feel like, you know, even when they come over to the bench after, you know, his second free throw, and we were drawing up a play just in case he did make it, they were pretty locked in, pretty engaged as far as, you know, if he does make it, you know, we'll find a way to get a clean look. And, I mean, if we had gone to overtime, you know, they had been through so much this year that I think, you know, we would have bounced back well and, you know, trying to find a way to win the game.
What are those moments like in the locker room before the media comes in when you're sitting there and you realize how close, you know, you felt like you had the game won and instead you're going home? What's that feeling like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you just feel for the kids because they're all just devastated. You know, seeing a bunch of your guys just, you know, hugging each other and crying and just heartbroken as far as how the game ended was tough. But, you know, they were all very accountable. And, you know, coach came in and basically said, we're going to handle this loss, you know, just like we would in victory with class. And we're going to handle it the right way. And as a coach, Doug, the coolest thing of the whole situation was kind of getting feedback from guys in the media after the open locker room, basically saying, I've never seen a kid like Samir or a team like Auburn handle such a difficult situation that well. So as devastating as it was to be, you know, because you know how hard it is to get to a Final Four. I mean, it's damn near impossible to get there. And to be so close to, you know, playing in a game to win a national championship and having it end the way it did, while it was all devastating, obviously incredibly proud of, you know, the kids, how they handled the moment, and just kind of how they represented themselves and the university.
How are you guys so successful in spite of the turnovers? Like, right? Because it does violate some of the laws of basketball, which is like, you know, like I tell kids all the time, like, look, you know, if you just don't turn the basketball over, like I told a couple of coaches, actually Texas Tech guys, they were getting ready to play Michigan, and they were like, how do you beat Michigan? How do you stop them? And I go, just don't turn it over. Like, literally, yeah, they can't score. They know they really can't score. If you don't turn it over, which sounds easy, but you guys do. You allow them so much freedom, not just with shot selection, but also, you mentioned, you know, some of the kicking the ball out of bounds sometimes, you know, the New Mexico State. Mm-hmm. How are you guys able to be so successful in spite of the turnovers?
I mean, I think at the end of the year, didn't turn it over as much, which, you know, you saw, and I think it was one of the biggest reasons why we went on our run. But at the same time, when we turn the ball over, I think we were number two in the country in turnover percentage. So we create, you know, a ton of extra possessions every game because we turn other people over. So we're able to get those turnovers back just with how we play defense. So we're able to survive that because we don't limit possessions. We're trying to get the possessions up into the, you know, high 70s, low 80s. In games. So when we do kind of get sloppy at the ball and turn it over, we're also creating a pace that gets them to do the same thing. So we're able to get those possessions done. So I think our ability to turn people over allows us a little more freedom at turning the ball over. But at the end of the year, you know, you looked at our turnovers. We didn't turn over that much over our last 10 games. We did a really good job of playing fast while taking care of the ball. And part of it too is, you know, we'd put a shot up before we could turn it over. So it limited turnovers in postseason play, which was really good.
Yeah, it's funny. You actually only had 6 turnovers in the game against Virginia, which is, you know, part of that is, you know, the way in which they play. Yeah, it reminds me of Dave Wojcik, who was the coach at San Jose State. I remember he was one of his first years there. I was doing a game, and he goes, "Look, I told them to shoot whenever they want, as long as they can't turn over, they shoot."
That's right.
That was before you can turn it over.
That's what BP says.
One of your closest friends is Todd Golden. He just got the job at San Francisco. Yep. Obviously, he used to be with you guys at Auburn before. He was an assistant at San Francisco, kind of going back home. What's it like to see a friend like in the coaching community? What's it like to see one of your boys at such a young age get such a great opportunity?
Yeah, I actually was on the phone with Todd right before we talked to you, and he was, you know, trying to get us to come out to the Bay to play a game. it's great to kind of see him be so successful. And, you know, he obviously took a huge risk leaving, you know, an SEC assistant position to go out to San Francisco to be the associate head coach in a league where you have Gonzaga and St. Mary's and BYU and some of the teams that kind of normally finish in those top three. And then all they do is just rack off 21 seasons every single year. And it all worked out perfectly for him. And, you know, kind of said this from day one, knowing Todd, is he's a rising star in the profession. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if he gets out there in San Francisco, you know, has two really good seasons, and then, you know, he'll end up being one of the youngest Power Five head coaches in one of those leagues. I think that highly of him. But just to see his success and kind of see that tree of coaches, you know, that we've kind of had here, or just trees, you know, under BP, kind of grow and watch guys like him get head jobs. It couldn't happen to a better guy. You know, he's an amazing coach, and obviously just really excited for him and kind of what he's going to be able to do with that program.
Okay, what about you? I mean, like, look, it's actually been a super meteoric rise, right? And and on the other hand, like, there's always going to be, he's Bruce Pearl's kid. And so some guys who are the son, they just sit there and they ride it out. You know, like, I've talked to Kellen Sampson, who, you know, now he got the title of, like, future head coach, whatever it is, head coach designate at Houston. It's still a hard thing. Like, it's not something that he wanted, but it's not something you can turn down. So really, what for you, what does the future hold?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's only my second year as an assistant coach, and, you know, we've won two SEC championships and been to a Final Four. So, you know, resume is, you know, it's solid right now. But I think part of it is, you know, figuring out what the best opportunity is for me moving forward, whether that's in a head coaching job at a low major, mid major, if that, you know, if the opportunity presents itself, or, you know, go get my, you know, my feet wet under another, you know, really good head coach, trying to find another guy in the profession, who I can learn from, work under, and vouch for. Cause at the end of the day, you know, he is our head coach, and, you know, but the word of your dad only goes so far sometimes. So getting out there and getting, you know, someone else that, you know, that you can work for and teach you some things and kind of get your name out there. So, gotta be the right situation. But definitely just, you know, looking to learn as much as I possibly can while I'm here, and then kind of assess the next opportunity. So, you know, tons of options. Just gotta, you know, figure it out as they come.
You guys faced off with Duke early in the season. That was all the way back in Maui. You saw Zion, I know, in high school, right? I mean, all those, you guys all saw him. There's a lot of people like, oh yeah, we knew, like, no one knew he was going to be this dumb. Like, did you know he would be what he became as a college player?
I had a feeling he'd be really good in college, just because when you look at him in person, you see his explosion, his quickness, and just the way he gets from point A to point B, he does it better than anyone. And that was going to translate over in the college game. Obviously, you know, his shot making was the one knock on him in high school, because he was so much stronger and he was so much more athletic and quicker than everyone else that he could just get to the rim whenever the hell he wanted and dunk or finish over people at ease. So would that have translated over into the college game? So we knew that he'd be a great college player. But to this level, I mean, I'm not sure if anyone knew how good he was going to be. And I think part of that is just how hard he's worked on his game. And, you know, he's – so now to answer your question, I knew he'd be good. I did not know he'd be this good.
How did everybody how did everybody miss on John Morant?
That's a good question. I think part of it was maybe the AU team he played for, you know, a small AU team in South Carolina that's got a bunch of really tough, scrappy players, you know, guys that really wouldn't go noticed because they don't play in the big tournaments. You know, it takes guys that will go into side gyms and spend time in side gyms that no one else is going to be in. I think, you know, the guys at Murray State did that, and they recognized it right away. So I think part of it is just, you know, he didn't play on the most prominent team to kind of get in front of the most prominent coaches. And there's only
so many places that we're able to kind of be in the summer. And, you know, it's not as, and sometimes it's so spread out that you're just missing a ton of stuff. So it's kind of one of those things where, you know, if you sometimes you land in the right gym at the right time, kind of like we did with, you know, with Jared Harper early in his career. BP was in Chuma Okeke. BP was inside gyms watching the Georgia Stars young teams, and just kind of fell on those guys and started on them early. Now, John Morant's a little different because he didn't play for the Georgia Stars. He, you know, played for like Team South Carolina or something. So I think part of it is just being so too spread out, and there being so many different locations, which it's gotten better, but that's what causes you to miss on some guys like that.
Yeah, and look, guys also get better. Like, that's one of the things that, like everybody thinks that everyone missed. Like, we're going to have Phil Beckner on here, part of this pod, and he was at Weber State when Damian Lillard was there. And you know, everybody's like, well, everybody in Oakland missed on, everybody in the Pac-12 missed on Damian Lillard. My brother's like, look, he was a, you know, 6'1", 2 guard. And, then he just, he worked and worked and worked and made himself into a great player, like a great player. Yeah. And it's a credence to him. And then obviously to assistant coach, they can see what a guy has within him. The hardest guy to prepare for this year, the best player you thought you coached against, you preparing so much of the defense. You guys faced Kentucky, LSU, Duke. Yep. Who would you say it is?
Oh, man. Obviously, you know, T.J. Washington was a tough one just for us because, you know, with his ability to shoot the ball, and then in addition, you know, his ability to push you up inside. So personally, that was one. The one guy I was actually really concerned about was Cassius Winston. That was my scout. If we had made it to the championship game, Michigan State had won. Just watching, you know, I watched like 10 or 15 games of them, and they run so much stuff, and he's involved in it in so many different ways, whether he's, you know, setting pin downs and getting rescreens, or he's in ball screens and he's just doing a million different things. You got a key on him, but then, you know, if you do lock him up, he's able to get 10 or 15 assists in a game. So, really, all year, I felt pretty good about a lot of our coverages, but PJ was one of them. And then watching Cassius, you know, in the week leading up to the Final Four, I think he'd have been a handful for us.
Last thing, the most underrated, you take your staff out, the most underrated coach in the SEC. You get to see all these teams, a ton of teams in the SEC. I think sometimes the coaching goes by the wayside because we talk about the players and everything else. You, the most underrated coach in that league is who?
Right now, my most underrated coach before last year was Mark Fox. X's and O's wise, I thought he was really good. They ran great stuff. But now in this league?
You don't have to make one up. If they all stink, yeah, it's okay. I'll just say that you think they all stink. It's okay. You think you could draw circles around all their stuff. It's okay. I'm kidding.
Yeah, I mean... I mean, it's got to be. I mean, honestly, you want the best answer? I think it's Cal. As good as he is, like, recruiting, the way he's able to get that collection of talent and sometimes personality to buy in, he's able to deal with all the outside noise all in the early season when people say that they're not good. He's done a bad job. And then every year he just kind of finds a way at the end of the year for them to kind of start clicking. And, you know, I forgot what the number is on his Elite Eights, but he's been to Elite Eight like 6 out of the last 8 years or something like that. That's, you know, it's really hard to do that. And he's never up, you know, he wasn't up for National Coach of the Year this year, which, you know, was kind of mind boggling. But I don't know if he's underrated, but he definitely doesn't get as much credit as I think he deserves sometimes.
Non-basketball. Greatest part about greatest moment you've been at Auburn?
It was when Auburn football beat Georgia and then Alabama when they were both number one. Those like 3 weeks during the season were just unbelievable, and to kind of see Coach Malzahn and those guys, you know, beat two number one teams within a matter of a few weeks was incredible. And obviously the energy around campus was amazing, and you know, they stormed the field after the Alabama game, won the SEC West. So that was probably the best non-basketball memory we've had since we've been here.
Does BP still get a boat, or is that only a Tennessee thing?
I think if he ever asked for one, he could definitely get one. I think he's looking at a lake house here in the future, which would be cool. But he honestly haven't had time to kind of get out on the boat. So not like it was in Tennessee. But I think if he ever wanted one, he could probably get one.
All right. Well, listen, you've been more than generous with your time. Congratulations on what was an incredible season. And look forward to talking with you off air, maybe bringing your dude Hayes down to basketball camp this year.
Hey, we'll send you the dates. We'll pick him out. Me and my boy Hayes, we'll kick it. It'll be fun.
You got to see his jump shot. It's kind of wet now. Like, you know how lefties always have it? Like, now, I mean it's spinning, right? He's kind of shooting with one hand. Like, he's... You should have seen this is actually a really funny site. So I didn't let last year he was third grader, I didn't let him shoot threes. None of them, right? So I have one now that can get it there and can shoot it without throwing it, whatever. So he made one and he got fouled in the game last weekend. And I go, and they didn't call a foul. He's like, "Dad, did you see that and one on a 3-point shot?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "You know the song Old Town Road?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "It was in my head, and when I shot it, right when the ball went in, the beat dropped."
No. My guy, Hayes, that's hilarious.
He's a character.
He's a beauty, man.
He is. All right, man. Thanks for your time, and we appreciate you joining us in the All Ball Podcast.
Yeah, brother. Appreciate you, man.
All right, that's it for this edition of All Ball. Make sure you download, subscribe, listen to the radio show, 3 to 6 Eastern, every day, Monday through Friday, on Fox Sports Radio. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.